Hey, what is up, email geeks? You are tuning into the Email Design Podcast, your favorite home for talking all things email design, development, and marketing. We are your hosts. I'm Kevin Mandeville.
And I am Jason Rodriguez.
And we have got a rapid fire community question and answer session coming up today. We're going through the Litmus community, finding some good threads, good questions, and coming back to you with what we think on the topics, trying to help you out with your email campaigns. So what do we got for our first question, Jason?
All right, the first one's a little bit of an older question, but I think still perfectly valid. Something that people don't talk about that much. This is using transparency in email. So William Vasali posted a couple of years ago on whether or not we should use transparency in an email and how to best do that. So the issue he was running into, that he was trying to make an element transparent or partially transparent, but the text, essentially like a background image, but the text on top of that was also dimming, essentially, too, because he was most likely using something like opacity, which is a CSS property that allows you to affect the transparency. But the thing with opacity is that when you apply it to an element, then it affects all child elements as well. So if you have a table cell with a background image and then text within that table cell and you apply opacity to the table cell, then everything's going to be affected in there. So I think the best advice comes from Mark Robbins. The two things that are probably a better way to control transparency are using transparent background images, so PNG files, and then using the RGBA color property, which allows you to declare a color using RGBA, but then the A is for alpha, which allows you to affect the transparency of those individual elements. So he has this great background property that's in the post that has both of those techniques in play, so it works at it over a wider range of email clients. This is one of those things that's not going to work everywhere, but it still has fairly good support. I think that support's probably grown a lot since Mark Robbins posted this about 2 years ago, but that's probably the best way to go about transparency these days, is using transparent background images, PNGs, or using the RGBA color property to affect transparency.
Yeah, the tough thing about this from a design strategy perspective is that, you know, those CSS classes of opacity, RGBA, they're not going to be supported everywhere. Yep. And when you're dealing with opacity, that's something that's really fundamental to the design. So it's not necessarily a subtle enhancement all the time. So that's why it's hard to sort of mix the two, and why if you do have, you know, even as low of an audience of Outlook, and that's a core audience for you, even though it's not necessarily as big in the market share, you probably still need to just use, you know, PNGs and control the opacity that way, because it's the only way that it's going to be supported across clients. So that's the tough part about it, but it's probably the most bulletproof. You want to make sure you're careful of your file sizes if you ever get into that.
Well, the nice thing about that, though, is if you're using a transparent PNG file, you can essentially do the 1x1 pixel type pack, and just so you have a very, very small file size, but then just set that to repeat both across the X and Y axes, and, you know, that'll keep that file size down, but still allow you to do it. Similar to that old transparent GIF kind of hack that people used to use for spacing.
Yep. So that is much better for performance optimization, if you can do that. Again, though, that just increases the code complexity as well. So there's trade-offs all along the way for how you do it and the considerations you have. But yeah, the most bulletproof way is still going to be the transparent, you know, PNG or GIF file, whatever you want to do. So good to keep in mind. All right, next question coming from Michael Varga, asking about image carousels in Gmail. Has anyone gotten them to work again within Gmail? I know that carousels used to be supported in Gmail before the responsive support update last fall. And the answer is no, they are no longer supported. So though we gained responsive support with media queries, thanks to the September update from Gmail in 2016, we lost the ability to have interactive emails. They used to support the checked pseudo selector, and they removed support for that pseudo selector along with this update. So unfortunately, the only thing that we do have that's working for interactivity in Gmail is the hover effect. So you could do hover, but that's not necessarily a true carousel, or may have the desired functionality that you're really looking for. So unfortunately, there's no way of supporting it. There's not even a hack around it, which was the sad part about that update, Jason.
Yeah, definitely sad to see. You know, it's I think the name of the game for email is trade-offs. So we got some cool things from the Gmail update, but lost other things. And unfortunately, right now, there's not too much we can do about it. So kind of have to live our lives, have cool fallback experiences for those image carousels, and just go about our work. All right, the next question is from Perry Clark, which he asked a couple of days ago whether or not Outlook.com supported MSO conditionals. They weren't working for him. So essentially, it breaks down to Outlook.com doesn't use the word rendering engine. So MSO refers to Microsoft Office, and most versions of Outlook after, well, every version of Outlook after, what, 2007, use the word rendering engine on Windows, at least. The Outlook versions for Mac use WebKit. But those using Microsoft Office allowed us to target that rendering engine by using MSO conditionals. So since Outlook.com is a web client, it's not using that Word version. So you can't necessarily use those conditional comments to target that version. But you can still use, I believe, the OWA class to target Outlook.com and Office 365, which essentially just prepending your classes with that OWA in the square brackets in your CSS to handle things like that. Are there any other kind of hacks we could use for that, Kevin?
No, you know, if you're going to target Outlook.com or Office 365, just use that OWA attribute selector hack for targeting in the CSS. There's no other method of targeting Outlook.com as far as I know. And yeah, if you're just trying to target Word, then you can use the Outlook conditionals. Those are really your two weapons of choice. I guess the only other way you could target is figuring out maybe, you know, if a particular client supports something or not. So I know for like Outlook desktop on the Word rendering engine, I've been using a lot more of Microsoft specific CSS properties. And we have, there's over 200 of them, believe it or not. A lot of people don't even know that, but they're listed out in the Litmus community article on Outlook. So if you, you know, search for Litmus community Outlook in the wiki, we have that whole list. There's things like MSO-padding-alt and other stuff. But yeah, it's not as unique for Outlook.com. It's really just that attribute selector targetable hack. So
makes sense. All right, tell me a little bit about the supports directive, Kevin.
Yeah, so this is something that's going to be more and more important the further we go along here throughout the years, and that is the @supports declaration. So Daniel Black asks, has anyone done work with CSS @supports? I've made an animation and I'm considering wrapping the whole thing in supports with a fallback animated GIF. I think I saw Litmus's emails using this properly for web video. Am I imagining this and just asking for some feedback? The answer is no, we have never used this for any type of progressive enhancement for video. That we typically refer to the WebKit targeting media query at WebKit min device pixel ratio of 0. But with the @supports function, what's great about this is that you can get more granular with what you're actually targeting. The hacks that we've often used and promoted have sort of been catch-alls for specific rendering engines like WebKit, like the Gecko rendering engine of Firefox using something like Moz, min device pixel ratio, things like that. It's a catch-all for an entire rendering engine, but sometimes you would like to get further in detail over what clients you're actually targeting. And that's what supports allows you to do. And we actually use this for our recent newsletter where we use CSS Grid. Mm-hmm. So not all WebKit clients supported CSS Grid. So we were able to use the @CSS supports declaration and basically say whatever client supports display grid, enact this CSS, enable this CSS. And that's what we did and how we were able to leverage CSS grid. So it's something that we haven't done a ton of, and we only have one email example using it so far, but it's going to become more and more important, Jason, because you know the WebKit prefix is going to be dying out anyways. That's going to be removed. And there's just going to be probably further fragmentation along the way with supports. And so you know, you being able to use supports to clearly identify what you're trying to target is just vastly helpful.
Yeah, totally. This is, again, one of those things that's becoming more prominent in web design, especially as CSS Grid and Flexbox, all those new CSS layout tools are becoming available. And I think it's going to be increasingly important, like you said, in email design as well.
All right. I'm going to talk about next question, best practices for hiding and showing interactive content fallbacks, which is related to this at supports. So Jeremy Snyder asked if anybody had a reliable set of styles they were using for hiding and showing their content. And so he was showing his way in which he has two separate table cells, one with the interactive content, one with the fallback content. And so just giving each of those unique classes and targeting them that way. And so, yeah, really the way that you do it is you put the content next to each other, whether you have them in separate cells or they're on top of each other, however your layout, you prefer it in your layout. You want to hide the interactive content by default and then turn it on for clients where it's supported, either using WebKit targeting or supports targeting, like we just mentioned. And then that way the fallback version is really the foundation and is displayed by default. And the way in which, you know, typically would hide it, just give it a display none. Display none is now widely supported thanks to Gmail finally supporting it with their update last September. Use display none just to hide it, turn it on with the display block of important, and then hiding the fallback content. And then what I like to do, because it's just the easiest, hiding for Microsoft Outlook Word, just simply use Outlook conditional comments to comment out that interactive content. And then that way it doesn't even render in Microsoft Word. So that's the simple framework that we use for hiding and showing interactive content. It used to be a way lot harder when Gmail didn't support display none and you had to like set widths and heights to zero and all this jankiness. But now it's pretty simple and straightforward.
Yeah, I don't think I have anything else to add to that other than, you know, I like that approach. That kind of progressive enhancement is more and more the way to go. Have the fallback first, enhance where necessary, and you have your good, great email going out to your subscribers. All right, this next question, this one I found really interesting, but this solution was surprisingly simple. This is a question from Jonah Goodman. He posted about emoji variations within the same email client. So looking at an email in Chrome for OS X, there was an emoji in the subject line that in the inbox view displayed one way, but then when he drilled down into the email itself, that individual email, in the subject line at the top there in Gmail, it displayed the emoji in a completely different style. So there's this great graphic. It's a rocket ship. So I thought this was really interesting. Like, why the hell would Gmail be doing something like that? So our good friend Mark Robbins, as always, came to the rescue and did some research and found out that it's essentially Gmail engineers being not necessarily lazy, but, you know, not thinking through, I guess, how those emojis are displayed across those two different views. So when you're in the inbox view, the emoji is displayed using Unicode, so it's down to the browser or operating system for how it's going to display that. So in the case of this, he's on OS X, so he sees the Mac version of the rocket emoji. But then when you get to the actual message view of that email, then Gmail's rendering engine takes over and uses the Gmail version of emoji to display that. So it replaces that Unicode version with the Google image emoji, which is a completely different look for this rocket. So I thought that was interesting. You know, Jaina kind of said, you know, it's just Gmail being Gmail. That's kind of what they do. And I think that's definitely the case here. This from a couple of years ago, I haven't seen this tested recently. I'm not sure if it's still a problem or not, but if you are seeing different looking emoji versus the inbox and the message view, then that's most likely the culprit.
Who knew? But yeah, this just goes to show whenever you see rendering discrepancies, like you need to ask yourself, well, what is actually the thing that's rendering this item? And, you know, that's, I think, the missing component for so many people is they say, why is this broken? But they never ask, well, what is rendering it? Because that typically will give you insight as to why there may be unintended behavior or rendering that you just didn't expect. So,
All right, before we go on to the next conversation, I want to take a quick moment to remind everybody to check out emaildesignpodcast.com for all of the latest episodes, show notes, links to resources, all the good stuff we talk about here, we throw up on emaildesignpodcast.com. You can follow along on Twitter using the hashtag emaildesignpodcast. If there's any breaking news or anything you want to see discussed on the show, then just tweet us there. And you can subscribe via SoundCloud, iTunes, and YouTube. So your platform of choice, just hit us up over there and get your latest episodes of the Email Design Podcast. And we also want to remind you to take Litmus for a test drive. Last episode, we were talking a little bit about spam testing, the new relaunch of spam testing in Litmus, which is amazing. We fully encourage you to check that out during this episode too. Go right now and check that out. You know, it's far beyond the old version of spam testing that just looked at a couple of different spam filters. We have support for, you know, checking your IP address blacklisting, looking at your DMARC records, all of your records you have to set up for good deliverability, on top of all of the different spam filters that we're checking your email against. My favorite part is that we now provide tons of contextual information about any problems you may encounter during your spam testing that'll give you insight as to what's going on and, more importantly, how to correct those problems. So if you feel like taking the new version of spam testing for a trial, just head over to litmus.com/giftcard and use the coupon code podcast for a 14-day free trial.
All right, we're going to get into video and email. So our good friend, Paul Airy, definitely check him out. We're going to have him on the podcast as a guest at some point. Yeah. But he's got a book, a type of email. Really,
he'll be talking at the conference, Litmus Live in London this year as well, which
that
is cool.
That is true. So he's going to be one of the speakers. Can check him out there as well. So Paul Airy, he asks, and this was posted a year ago, but a lot's happened, so we wanted to cover this. Has anyone successfully embedded video in an email recently? And if so, how have you gone about it? Now, like I said, a ton has changed. And actually, I just am fresh off doing a presentation all about video and email at Wistia Fest. And so we have some updated figures for everybody. Believe it or not, thanks to iOS now supporting HTML5 video again with the reintroduction of iOS 10, still need to test out, I guess, iOS 11, but assuming nothing changes, we are back at 42% for the market share for HTML5 video. And that's solely counting iPhone and iPad iOS, because Apple Mail and Outlook for Mac have a little bit of asterisk with them because their controls don't really work in the email. Like, the video still works, but the controls are sort of broken. So I don't really consider that true support. It's still janky. Like, it used to work fine. I don't really know what happened, but that figure is solely counting iOS. So that's really positive news. But given that, and given the experience for Apple Mail and Outlook for Mac, what I would really do is I would only ever serve it up for those iOS users. And so this is where actually the support targeting comes in really handy. Remy Parmentier found out a way to target only iOS 10, which we have in our Litmus iOS 10 blog posts on rendering, in which you're basically targeting anything that supports the WebKit touch scrolling and then the four-digit hexadecimal color value. And those are things that only iOS 10 and
what
above.
What a weird
supports.
One. That hex value thing is super weird.
It's such a weird one, but it's amazing because you can just target iOS 10. So this is where, and this is why we ordered the questions. You would use supports to target iOS 10, and then you would have your interactive content hidden by default, and then your fallback content shown by default, and then just switching those on and off for iOS 10. And that's the strategy that I would use for using native embedded HTML5 video, unless we were doing the background video technique, which has a little bit better support in Apple Mail and Outlook for Mac as well. But that's a little bit different, and that is video not using sound and things like that. So, but that would be the approach that we would take, Jason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like it. Ad sports is coming in hand again, so that's awesome to see. The next question comes from Veronica Williams, posted 2 days ago. Another Castle question. So we talked a little bit about the recent news in last week's episode on Castle and the private right of action delay, so that companies or people can't sue companies just yet. That's been delayed at least for a couple of months, most likely. But Veronica had this great question. I think this one's really interesting about whether or not it's against the Castle laws to make certain fields required in your email newsletter signup form. So she mentions that she's not pre-checking anything. So in my mind, this email signup form has, you know, your name, the input field for your email address, and then a checkbox for whether or not you want to receive emails from this company. So that checkbox isn't pre-checked, but she's asking whether or not making that checkbox required is against the CASA law. So in my mind, I'm not a lawyer or anything like that, but I would say that you would not want to make a checkbox element required, because that's essentially making it required that they have to. In my mind, it's the same thing as pre-checking something. Since a checkbox only has two values, checked and unchecked, if it's unchecked and you require it to be checked, then it's the same thing as pre-checking it. So you can't do that according to CASA laws. But you can make things like, you know, your name or email address. I would say that's required. But if they don't check that checkbox, then they're still not consenting to opting into your email list. Does that make sense, Kevin? What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, no, I agree. It's an interesting argument. I don't know how it would go down in a court of law, but it's really getting down to semantics over the implementation. Yep. At the end of the day, that's still just a way to force users to opt in.
Yeah.
So it's really the same ends, just a different means. And so I don't really think that the means matter. It's we're trying to prevent that this ends from behavior of forcing users. So I would say I would say no, you shouldn't do that. You should steer clear of that.
And I think it comes down to the fact that she's using a checkbox, because that is like a Boolean element. It only has two values. So it's essentially, by requiring it, you're forcing it into that one value. Whereas if you had, you know, radio buttons or something like that, or I guess a form block with two checkboxes, either opt me in or don't opt me in, and requiring those two things to be filled out, and if they are allowed to select don't opt me into that, then that's a different scenario. But just having that one opt me in your newsletter, having that required, is the big problem here.
Yeah, it just follow. You got to follow the spirit of, yep, you know, yeah, the law too, and I think you'll earn subscribers trust more by really following the spirit as it is intended.
Yep, totally. All right, what's our last one, Kevin?
Our last one coming at us from David Abling, talking about centering text inside a button that works with Outlook. So, basically bulletproof buttons. And so what he's showing here, and I'm assuming he's using a framework as he's using the button tag, and he's using some compartmentalize or components of CSS here that are part of a framework. So he's using a center tag that's wrapped in the button tag, and just, you know, saying that he's having issues with Outlook. And the core reason is that Outlook isn't going to support that button. And, you know, if he's using Zurb's foundation for email, maybe this is getting converted into an actual link instead. Mm-hmm. But again, if you're still just using a link, you're going to be missing out on any type of padding that you may want, or having centered text, depending on what you're trying to do. Now, the center tag should be working in Outlook, mm-hmm, but there's a lot of things that could be going wrong. The table cell element could not be set to a line center that is nesting all of this content, that's wrapped this content. So this content that's nested, maybe its parent cell isn't properly aligning it, even though there's a center tag. For whatever reason, if you have like an align left or something, maybe it's overriding that. But I think the big thing is that, you know, if this is just a regular link, you really do need it to be in a table cell, in its own table and table cell, so that you can properly style it and give it that proper text centering. Otherwise, you may be having some issues. I'd say we really need some more insight into what the full code is here. But, you know, you would need to, in my opinion, instead of using the center tag, having this be its own table in table cell, which is nested inside the parent table cell within a line of center for both, which allows you to align the button center and then align the text center, is really the most bulletproof way. And then it gives you just more customization and flexibility for styling that element.
Yeah, totally agree. I think taking that approach and using good well-crafted and coded bulletproof buttons is the way to go. We actually wrote a blog post a while back on using bulletproof buttons. If you just do a search for Litmus blog bulletproof buttons, that should be one of the first few results. So that kind of breaks down these different ways of creating bulletproof buttons. There's no one necessarily right way to do a bulletproof button. So there's a couple of different techniques you can use. So definitely check that out, and that'll kind of set you on the right path.
And hey, we're going to keep doing these rapid fire Q&A questions. Just post into the Litmus community is the best way to do it. Make sure you go to litmus.com/community. Not only do you get maybe us talking about it on the podcast, we're there answering along with hundreds, thousands of other email geeks, lending our helping hand. Make sure you get the answer that you're looking for. And Jason, you're the moderator. You see stuff there all day. Yep. Engage with it. So
I see, you know, everything.
Jason does. Jason gets an email for everything.
Literally
that happens.
Literally everything that happens on community. I see it. Yeah.
So Jason's got your back, people. So yeah, definitely get involved that way. All right, that's going to do it. Another edition of the Email Design Podcast in the books. Remember, go to emaildesignpodcast.com. You can catch all the questions we talked about, all these links, and hey, full archive. Listen to every past episode of the podcast. Be sure to subscribe on YouTube, SoundCloud, iTunes. Podcast is all out there. Tweet along with the hashtag Email Design Podcast. And hey, we've got a free 14-day trial of Litmus for you. Just go to litmus.com/gift card and input the coupon code podcast. All right, see you next time, email geeks.